FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This week, we're continuing on with our bonus series as I continue to investigate and prep for Season 12, which is coming up right around the corner. I think we're only about 3 or 4 maximum weeks away. For these next couple weeks, last week we heard from Jim Clemente. For these next couple weeks, I'm going to be talking to some people who I just really respect in the true crime space that are really doing some great work. And today's guest is certainly no exception. His name is Josh Hallmark. He's a very good friend of mine. He hosts the True Crime Bullshit series. And on his show, he is investigating the victims of Israel Keyes, the serial killer, and has done a ton of work trying to identify those victims. It's a podcast with a mission. He's doing great work. It's very well produced. So I wanted to have Josh on to talk about not only what the show is, to give you guys a little taste of it, get to know Josh a little bit, but also his process and a huge accomplishment that he had in just these last couple of months. He's going to share all of that and more right after the break.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Well, I am joined by my friend and fellow podcaster, Mr. Josh Hallmark, who is the host and creator of one of my favorite shows, the True Crime Bullshit Podcast. Josh, are you enjoying you've had a little time off, a little mid-season break. Are you enjoying your time off?
Yeah. You know, it's nice to take 4 weeks off from thinking about serial murder 24 hours a day.
See, I tell you, it's hard to I took 1 week off. It's the first week I've had off in a little while. And I was telling you before we started recording, I just got back into work mode and was doing ad copy. I'm so frazzled that I forgot how to do everything. And I kind of missed just laying on the couch all week.
Today was my first day back. I'm not putting out new episodes, but I'm like, you know how it is. You fall behind with admin and you want to get research done. And it's impossible to do both of those while you're producing new episodes. So today's my first office day back. And I didn't know what to do with myself. It was like a 5 cup of coffee day.
Yeah. And as my wife says, I'm still full of cheese from all of the holidays. So my whole body is not functioning properly. So I wanted to, we've had you on True Crime Binge. If you want a whole bit deep dive into Josh, you go check out his True Crime Binge episode. But for you Truth and Justice listeners that haven't heard that, let's get to know Josh a little bit, let you know about who he is and his podcast. I will tell you that Josh Hallmark got me more drunk than I've been, I think, since I was in my 20s.
I recall it being the other way around, but you know, you tell whatever version of the story you want.
So Josh and I, you guys remember a few months ago, me and Josh and the captain all met in Cleveland to do a live show meetup. And this is what I remember. I remember being a little buzzed up. I remember a captain getting us a ride home with a stranger back to the hotel, which wasn't smart. And then you said we should get a bottle of wine from the front desk.
I mean, I don't have that same memory, but again, it's your show.
Right. The second bottle might have been my idea, but that was the worst hungover drive that I've had the next day in a really long time.
But I think we can agree it was actually the captain's fault, because he made us do shots of whiskey in the middle of the show, and I think we would have been fine were it not for those shots.
Right. And then, by the way, here's a little inside scoop. The captain had to drive back to Columbus, so he orders us shots at 7 o'clock when the show started. And then by 9 o'clock, Josh and I are well on our way to drinking, and the captain was drinking water because he had to drive home. So by the end of the night, he was sober. We were hammered. And I had whiskey, I had beer, and then we drank a bottle and a half of red wine back. We did, I think, solve pretty much all the world's problems that night, though.
Oh, yeah, of course. And I think we shut down the hotel. We were in that lobby till, I think, 3 a.m.?
Yes, something like that. Yeah, it was definitely a great time that we had out there. Now, that was the second time we've hung out in person. We actually got to meet at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Kansas City after my shit show of a plane ride out there that I got there right after the show was over, finally, that day.
It took you longer to get there than time spent there, which is a productive use of your time.
Right, it really was. And most of my time there was spent sleeping. But so Josh hosts the podcast, True Crime Bullshit. But prior to that, also, when I had you on True Crime Binge, people said they had a hard time searching. If they actually type in bullshit, is it hard to come up? Do they have to, because it's like True Crime Bull,
yeah,
SH, you know, star star or something.
Here's the thing. If there's one rookie move I've made, and someone is like, I'm sure you've made more than one. But the biggest one is calling it True Crime Bullshit, because you can't cuss on Apple Podcasts, even though we're all, you know, consenting adults. So it's True Crime Bull SH **. But if you do a search for True Crime Bull, it comes up immediately.
I was going to say, I think that the show is so popular now that when I was, I think I typed in TR the other day when I was trying to catch up on your episodes. And when I got to TR, I think True Crime Bullshit was like the second thing that came up. So you're doing pretty good on the Apple algorithm now.
Yes. Yes.
Didn't see True Crime Binge in that. I had to go way all the way to the E before I got to my show. But yours is doing great.
I'm sure you'll find your way into the search bar.
Right. So prior to doing True Crime Bullshit is not your first podcast. You started off, was it called Americana or My Americana?
Our Americana.
Our Americana.
Yeah, which was, you know, I enjoy storytelling, which is, I think, one of the things that separates True Crime Bullshit from a lot of other true crime shows is it's more focused on storytelling. Our Americana was very much just these interesting stories of communities and small towns either coming together or overcoming crises or overcoming strange events. And it was told, you know, through interviews with four or five different people sliced together. My personal favorite was a small town that was adopted by an orphaned orca calf because it lost its pod, and they thrive on social connections, and it needed someone mm-hmm. to have connections with. So it showed up in this town, in this bay, and never left, never with an asterisk. And this community, which had been like really segregated between white fishermen and hunters and locals versus the natives there, and these two very much separate communities came together in support of this little whale. And I think that's just a great example of what that show is. It's mostly really special, lovely, heartwarming stories about communities coming together.
It's cool that there's that, the kind of the medium of, in that case, like the whale tells a bigger story.
Yeah. And how, you know, we all can often overlook our own selves or our political stances or our histories in support of something greater than us, whether that's our community or the town that we live in and love or a creature that needs us.
You know, I think one of the things that I like hanging around with you is you've seen, I was just thinking about this the other day. So I come from a very rural part of Michigan. People think Michigan, they think Detroit and Lansing. I'm from a very rural part of Michigan. So it's a bunch of, you know, a bunch of white farming Republicans kind of around where I grew. So that's what I grew up around. And because of my career, I've been blessed enough that I've traveled a lot, some of the world, but a lot of the country. You know, I've been in the streets of Baltimore. I've been down to the very poor black communities in Texas and Arkansas, and just I've been all over the place, and I've seen all these different perspectives. And it really changes the way you think. And you've had a similar experience to that. Because was it while you were recording our Americana that you were kind of nomading across the country, or was that a separate experience?
It was immediately before. In fact, our Americana was kind of the, I guess, celebration of that trip. So my partner and I lived in a van for 6 months and traveled Canada and the country. I think the longest we stayed anywhere was 2 weeks. But most places we were there for like 2 or 3 nights and just kind of saw America. And it really gave us a lot of really critical insight into our place in America and our privilege and just communities we didn't know about and politics. This was during the 2015 primary, so it was an interesting time.
Oh, nice. And, right, yeah.
And we would, you know, he's a little more outdoorsy than I am. And so we stayed in a lot of RV parks, and I'm very politically active. We would go into like the rec rooms in these RV parks in the middle of the woods and watch the debates with all these other RV people. And it was just such an eye-opening experience, especially because I had been, you know, raised in San Francisco and had only ever lived other than a short stint in New Orleans in West Coast major cities. So it was great for me to see people with very different lives and backgrounds and perspectives than I had.
It's cut a lot of, I don't know that I really ever had hate, but for lack of a better term, hate out of my life, and a lot more tolerance of people to see the different back. As an example, I was with a group of guys, older guys, just the other day, and they were talking. I was out to breakfast, and they were talking politics and something about the case. I'm drawing a blank on the name. The woman who the female cop who pulled her gun instead of the taser.
Oh yeah,
you know, and they got and you know, they're saying, well, they, oh, that whole thing, if he would just comply, this wouldn't happen. And listening to these guys, and it's so easy for people to like hate on that viewpoint. But I've seen enough and got to know enough people to know that so many of these perspectives come from ignorance, from never being outside of their bubble. And I just said, so there's me sitting there with six guys in their 70s at a breakfast place. That's the kind of life I live. I don't party. And I said, you know, you guys have never been to these places and lived the lives of like that guy. So it's easy for you to say, well, why didn't he just comply? But you don't know what his last 15 encounters with the police looked mm-hmm. like and why they might have had that reaction to the police. And shockingly, they were all like, oh, I guess I never really thought about that. And on the same token, I've got friends that like live in Hollywood that are very kind of in their little bubble, and they think everybody from the Midwest is a bunch of redneck racists. And it's like, not, you've never really lived that life either. There's something, not to get all political things, but I like to be around people that have been around the country and have been with different groups of people and have taken the time. We sat up that night when we were drinking wine until 3 a.m. just talking about different perspectives, and you enlightened me on things. I'm sure I enlightened you on many things that night.
Of course.
And you're a better man for it.
Right? Well, I think even just like the greatest thing, well, I mean, I learned so much on that trip, but the one thing that really has stuck with me is the privilege of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's very easy for me in my past life to have been in San Francisco and really just been constantly surrounded by people wildly different than me, socioeconomically, mm-hmm. Racially, religiously, not politically in San Francisco, but everything else. And then not really having an understanding of like why social issues maybe wouldn't be as important to someone from, you know, small town Ohio or whatever.
Right.
And not really, or taking for granted that I had the privilege of experience of living in these big cities or traveling and meeting people who are different than me and having a much deeper and more personal perspective on their journeys. And so I've learned to be less angry when people aren't prioritizing social issues and more understanding of like, well, they haven't had the same experiences I have. So yeah, you know, It was a very humbling, eye-opening trip. Also, just like being gay and being so worried about going to certain places and then realizing, like, debatably, I can hide that I'm gay. A lot of people can't hide the things that ignorant people hate about them. So it was just like such a humbling experience.
Well, and then kind of transitioning into your show, then you take that kind of enlightenment into, so when I listened to True Crime Bullshit, the first, I was just listening to it because I was having you on the show, wanted to get, and to be honest, my first thought was, well, so the podcast in general, you had a season that covered other things, but is about the serial killer Israel Keyes. And I was like, you know, it's another guy talking about a serial killer. I've never really, I'm kind of fascinated by him, but I don't spend much time thinking about them. And immediately, you started really early on, you started asking some really tough questions. You started asking questions of your audience and even bringing people on to answer those questions about, you know, should we be talking about this? Should we be digging into it? And why are we so interested? And just started, it was a perspective I wasn't expecting from the show. And I found it really, really engaging. Even bringing up some of those ethical issues that we as podcasters face all the time.
You know, I would be lying if I said it wasn't my intent to challenge people, including myself, in the production of the show. But I think, you know, when you do deep dives like we do, you kind of get the idea and then you do the FOIA and then the files come in and you live and breathe those files for weeks or months or years, and you get really wrapped up in the case, and then you sit down and you start to actually like create the show, and you think like, oh, there are all these ethical questions I haven't asked myself about creating this show. And that's the place I found myself in, and I just thought, like, I haven't really heard anyone else do this. Let's just invite those questions into the show. Like, should I be doing this? If sociopathy or psychopathy are mental illnesses, then they are outside the control of the people who are suffering from them. So should we have empathy for those people, even if they are serial killers? Which is not a fun question to ask. I would much rather live in the black and white, but unfortunately, just nothing's black and white. And so I just thought, like, for every tough question I'm asking myself in doing this show, I'm just going to bring it into the show. And, you know, a lot of people did not like that. They didn't want to be challenged. They didn't want to consider thinking of serial killers as anything other than evil, which is understandable. And I think the people who did, hopefully, at most, were profoundly impacted by it and have taken that out into their normal lives of, like, everything is gray, everything is about perspective, and at a minimum, just, you know, took a moment to think about it and how that affects policy and mental health in this country and healthcare and just, you know, everything is connected.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it, and it made me uncomfortable. It really did, because you sort of asked out loud the questions that I'm constantly asking myself internally when I'm doing what you do, right? When I'm doing a deep dive and doing the podcast and producing it, and then you said it out loud and was like, like, was like, you mean I'm not the only one that worries about these things? But it was really interesting. And then you kind of lay out, and I don't know, was this kind of the mission from the beginning, or did it evolve to be that? Because your mission became, or at least it became clear to me, a little ways into season one, that the mission wasn't just to tell a story about a serial killer, that the mission was to try to find some closure and try to, you know, the crazy thing about Keyes is we don't know who all his victims were. You know, he killed himself before we found out who all of his victims were. And so you set out to identify his victims. There was a clear mission to the show. Was that the plan from the beginning, or did it evolve into that?
Sort of. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, actually, how, you know, and it's been almost 4 years now, where, like, when I started this, I never would have used the word investigation, capital I, because I think it just felt way bigger than me. Like, who am I to investigate a crime? But it's kind of what I had been doing all along. And I think it was a lot of what was driving me. I think when I sat down and started actually writing the series, there were two motivating factors for me. The first was like, there are families out there who don't know what happened to their loved ones. And like, maybe there's clues in these files. And again, it wasn't like, I'm going to be the one to do it. But it was like, but let's look and see if there's anything in here. And then the other factor was like his kid, who he was the best parent she had, because her mother struggled with addiction and was in and out of her life. And he really took care of her the best that he knew how. And she was, I think, 13 when he was arrested. And so just like having that as the legacy of her dad, who she lived with full time for the majority of her life, and what that means for her, and how she sees him, and how she sees her childhood now, that she knows, you know, some truths about him. She doesn't, as far as I know everything at this point, but she knows enough. So that was it. It was like telling the story with care and with humanity for everyone, including him as much as we could. And also using that humanity and empathy and, I guess, lowercase I investigation to see what we could do to tie up some loose ends. You know, I don't like the word closure because it seems unrealistically and unkindly holistic. But I think, you know, to at least give people some resolve.
Yeah. And you know, it's when you talk about the, because you took some shit too for kind of personalizing, you know, because Israel went by is, and then you, there were people giving you a hard time for referring to him as is and kind of humanizing him. But it went back to me, and I guess it's a question to, for those in my audience listening, ask yourself this and see how uncomfortable it makes you feel. But when you, like you said a few minutes ago, so I think that he's a sociopath, psychopath. And like you said, if that's a true mental disorder, then that's kind of beyond his control. So where does that leave you? Like, is it okay to have some empathy there? Certainly, I mean, his victims would think so. And we, and you as well, and me have always been very victim-centric with the work that we do. But then it's like, but do you just write the guy off completely because he was a psychopath? If that's truly a mental disorder, it's a tough question to ask.
And there's no right answer. And I think a lot of people assumed that I had a bias or a leaning in even like challenging everyone, including myself, to think about those things. And I don't, like, I still to this day don't know if it's okay to have empathy for him. But I think it's a conversation that's worth having.
Yeah. And as especially, you know, for, like you mentioned, his daughter, like there's other people connected to this besides the victims. But, you know, as you're going on and you're doing your, as you call your lowercase I investigation, and you actually got results. I mean, we've been for a while trying to hook up to do this, but it was this fall, right? October or so when you had a pretty big revelation on the podcast.
Yeah, it was I think 2 weeks before the season 5 premiere, because there was a lot of scrambling to rewrite that first episode. And I was on the road when I found out, investigating the show and doing, you know, panels and stuff. So in season 4 of the show, I think, is that right? What season am I in? I don't know. Season 4, it sounds right. I now have a team of researchers, which is also just a wild thing because I was kind of like living on my own doing this for so long. And now there's other people, which is just lovely. But one of them had brought to my attention a doe. She had brought to my attention a missing person who had matched a doe that I had found. And that John Doe was discovered on November 4th of 2011, just 25 miles from Keyes' family compound in upstate Maine, which, you know, is suspicious when you find a doe near where a serial killer hangs out. And so we started looking to see, if there was enough information about the doe that we could plausibly link him to Keyes, or look into him as being a plausible Keyes victim, but also whether it was keys or not, because we spend so much time poring through missing persons cases, looking to see if we could link him to a missing person. His cause of death is still unknown to this day. There were signs that perhaps the body had been tampered with post-death, and the proximity to Keys and also the proximity to the highway that Keys takes to get to his family compound from his upstate New York cabin made it worth looking into, and we'd found a gentleman who disappeared from an area we can positively place Keys in multiple times around the same time that this doe was found. Height matched, even the sketches matched this man's photos. And so we reported on it as being a possible match, and both of them being possible Keys victims. Meanwhile, I get a lot of tips, which I'm so thankful for, every day. A few people had reached out to me and said, you have to look into this missing person, Christopher Roof, who disappeared from the New Hampshire-Massachusetts state line while Keys was active in the area. And so it was kind of on my to-do list. Hmm. And then one of his former students reached out and said, I think that doe you reported on could be Mr. Roof, who was a substitute teacher. And so she started doing some digging and used the information I put out on the show and reached out to me and said, I think this is him. Do you mind if I contact the police? And I said, please, by all means. And then, 2 weeks before season 5, they positively identified the Stacyville, Maine John Doe as Christopher Roof.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people are giving me credit for it. And it's, the show definitely helped make this happen, but, you know, Sidney Kopp is his former student who was listening to the show and heard this and said, I think this is Mr. Roof. She's the one who did the work. So where credit is due, I 85% of it goes to Sidney Kopp, because I have been doing this for years and I'm still anxious to deal with law enforcement a lot of the time because you never know what you're going to get. And she really had the bravery and audacity to not only reach out to them, but really stay on top of them to see this through. So, yeah. And now we know who the Stacyville John Doe is. His name is Christopher Roof. And now it's determining what happened to Christopher Roof and was Keys involved. But also, even if he wasn't, his loved ones need to know what happened to him, how he got to the woods.
Yeah, because for 10 years, he's just been missing. They didn't know where he was. Yeah, but you know, that's and certainly the student of his, it's all the credit for the work that she did. But that's also the power in what you do. It's what we try to accomplish with Truth and Justice too. Is, you know, the crowdsourcing element a lot of times is helping with research and helping go through crime scene photos. But a lot of times it's if we can put information out there to the world, it creates this opportunity for someone, because, you know, I believe that most people in the world want to do something good. They want to be a part of doing something great, of changing someone's life for the better. And I think you created that opportunity for that to happen. You know, even though she did the work and all the credit is due there, obviously, but I don't think that ever happens if you're not making the podcast telling the story to even help make that connection. And I think that's a powerful thing that you're doing.
Thanks. And, you know, we started our chat talking about my hesitancy to do this in the first place and it being part of the bigger discussion. And in 4 years, that has minimized, but it hasn't fully gone away. There are days, and I'm sure you feel this too, where I'm like, should I be doing this? Like, and we're 5 seasons into it. And I still am like, should I be doing this? And, you know, look, we've made great strides in the Keys investigation that I'm deeply proud of. We are very close to identifying, I would say, 4 victims. And that's amazing. And it's empowering and inspiring and humbling. But you still have those doubts. And so I this, whether it's keys or not, like knowing that I participated in giving a family their loved one back and giving a doe his name back, like, means the world to me at any level. So it's like, does it make it all worthwhile? I guess only the future can determine that. But for now, it's inspiring and invigorating.
Well, regardless of where things go from here, you can at least at this point be able to look back and say, you know, was there purpose behind what I was doing? Did we accomplish anything? And if you accomplished nothing else, that you have impacted real people's lives. The family members of that teacher now they no longer have a missing person. They know what happened, at least to an extent, where he's at. And so I just think it's a big, for me, things like that are very important. I'm always striving to do more and always trying to continue. But if I can look back and be like, at least this hasn't been in vain. You've done something. You've impacted lives because of the work that you're doing. And that's got to be something you got to be able to hang your hat on, you know, no matter what happens from here.
Yeah, no, it is. And like, I don't want to, you know, shoegaze about it. Like, I'm proud of it. I am. I just, you know, I'm always kind of looking at the bigger picture. And I think for me, the one thing I told myself, like, whenever I got bad feedback or people were dicks on the internet to me, it was like, at a minimum, we're bringing attention to a lot of missing persons and doe cases that have long been ignored. And I think this is a shining example of that, because Christopher Roof was not a Namus. He was not on the Charlie Project. There were no articles about him anywhere. There was a Facebook group with his former students. And so me reporting on him as a possible Keys victim, like, facilitated this happening. And I think that should be the takeaway for everyone, is as long as you are ethically reporting on missing persons cases, you are bringing attention to people who need more attention.
January 20th, did you say? Is that when you're coming back with the second half of season five?
Yeah. True Crime Bullshit will return on the 20th for the second half of season five. I think there are 9 episodes left in the season. Don't quote me on that. And we have made a lot of headway. We've had some very important and highly credible witnesses come forward who have had encounters with Keys that give us either a very clear understanding of his MO or supporting evidence and theories we already had. We have, like I said, 4 cases where there is very strong evidence that Keys was involved, including some physical evidence. And so I think it's continuing to pull back those layers until we can get to a place where we can positively confirm that they are Keys victims. And, you know, unfortunately, he was excellent at disappearing bodies. And so it's going to come down to just like very strong circumstantial evidence, unfortunately, unless we can find a body or a cache. And I think that's where we're at now, is we have a pretty confident general sense of where his hidden caches are. And we know he kept trophies in those caches. So
after season five, are you continuing on? Is there going to be a season 6?
I always say I never want to, I'm trying to think of like an apt analogy. I never want to like lost this podcast where I'm like on season 7 and everyone's like, we should have ended at 3. So
it's a good analogy.
Yeah. as long as there's more investigation to do and more clues to uncover, I'll keep doing it. And, you know, I took a break off and we covered a female serial killer for a season, and it made me want to hide under my sheets for a year because she sucked the life out of me. But you know, maybe we do that again and then return to Keys in a future season. But I've been investigating lowercase I Keys for almost a decade, and I don't think my need to know answers is ever going to go away. So I think whether we take a pause or not, the show will probably always be deeply rooted in Israel Keys.
Well, that's great. Well, I think you're doing great work. I love the podcast. I'm looking forward to the second half of season 5. And congratulations, man, on identifying if nothing else, identifying a missing persons, it's a huge accomplishment and speaks volumes of the work that you're doing.
Thank you. And thank you for being like just a great friend, but B, just such a wonderful cheerleader for this show. Cause it means the world to me that like people listen to this. And I always say the barrier to entry is like very large because it's, you know, 80 episodes on the same person. Right, yeah. It's quite intimidating. I don't know if it's 80, but it feels like it. And so I'm always just impressed and humbled when someone's willing to take that on and then like care about it. So thank you.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. And we'll have you back on next time after the next identification. I'm sure there's one coming around the corner.
Don't jinx it.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. And I personally can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth, and Mike can be found @MurbGaming, MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.